The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
It's the story of your life. Good morning, Glory America. It's Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, Bonjour High, Canada. On Wednesday, May the 5th, in the year of our Lord 2025, the big news yesterday, President Biden announcing that he intends by July 4 to have 70% of the country vaccinated. President Biden said he also wants 160 million adults in America to have the vaccine by that point, which means another 100 million shots over the next 60 days. The U.S. has administered about 220 million shots in Mr. Biden's first 100 days. The pace of vaccination has fallen in recent weeks. That was the Washington Post reporting on it. What about that vaccination pace? That's the subject of a story in the New York Times this morning. Why is it slowing? What's to blame? I thought that was a particularly disingenuous question and said so on Twitter yesterday. And say so now and for today's podcast for this simple reason. Everybody knows it's the CDC and the FDA's terrible decision to, quote, pause the Johnson & Johnson vaccine 2 weeks ago. It has caused a plummeting number of people to get vaccinated. It has also taken down with it, though not as dramatically, Pfizer and Moderna. We have to take big decisions away from the CDC and the FDA that are not medical driven. These are decisions that need to be made by public policy professionals who understand the amplification and social impact. That means the push effect of government declarations on efficacy of medicine. And they clearly do not understand that at the FDA and the CDC. And they haven't. For 15 months, they've been getting it wrong. And so it's time to take the wonderful people who mean only good out of this decision loop. They can't slow down this vaccination effort. Yesterday's other big story, or stories, because there were two, involved Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. And I remind you that she was formerly the head of the Federal Reserve. So she's uniquely positioned to move markets. Yesterday, early on, she caused confusion in her conversation about inflation, saying first, this is Janet Yellen early in the day, rates, interest rates may have to rise to prevent overheating. Now, you and I and everyone who listens to this show or podcast knows that inflation is coming. And in fact, it's already here and we're seeing it in things like lumber at Home Depot and Lowe's. But nobody in the White House wants to admit that because they're looking to spend another $2 trillion, and that means even more inflation. So although this is the first Wall Street Journal headline that I'm holding up here, which appeared midday, Yellen says interest rates may have to rise to keep economy from overheating. This is the second Wall Street Journal headline that appeared yesterday. Yellen says she isn't predicting higher interest rates. In fact, she predicted both in the course of one day, thus shooting her credibility. Crushing market, especially big tech yesterday, which is going to rebound today, I suspect. But Janet Yellen, you too have to learn how everything you say is like when you were at the Federal Reserve. Now, you thought because you became a secretary in the Treasury Department, you could freelance a little bit. Oh, no, still the same rules, because once a Federal Reserve chairman, always a Federal Reserve chairman. And they think you have mystical powers of a priesthood of financial wizards. And you're like the Dumbledore of interest rates. And Jerome Powell is like the Dumbledore in training, because you were there before he was, even though he's the guy that got the guy with the juice with the committee. Here's the deal. Just be quiet or be honest. You don't have to say anything, but if you're going to say something, be honest. The market can't lose credibility, faith in the Fed. Chuck Ross has left the Daily Caller and gone over to join Washington Free Beacon, and he did so with a bang. Big Chuck Ross with a huge story on the DOJ nominee to head the Civil Rights Division, Christian Clark, having lied to the Judiciary Department about her Judiciary Committee, about her participation in a conference that involved convicted cop killers being called political prisoners. At the Senate Judiciary Committee, on her hearing to lead the powerful Civil Rights Division, and it is very, very powerful, She said that in 1999 Columbia University conference, Black America versus the Prison Industrial Complex, had simply involved her participation as a technocrat. No, not the case, as Chuck Ross discusses in the Washington Free Beacon today. You can't lie to a confirmation committee. At least you shouldn't be able to. That should sink that nominee. Big story in the Wall Street Journal about Facebook. Facebook jail, specifically. What lands you in Facebook jail? Now, look, I know Mark Zuckerberg. I like Mark Zuckerberg. We carry on a very occasional correspondence. But Facebook is in the censorship business. Now, they're not the government, so they don't have to comply with the First Amendment. But they established this big diversion, this big head fake called the review committee, the high court, whatever you want to call it. They have a government within a government. They're trying to be a state within a state. And it's fine. Mike McConnell's on it. But so are a bunch of international lawyers with standards and methods that are nothing at all consistent with American constitutional law. And they're going to come down with a big decision today about whether or not President Trump is going to be allowed back on Facebook. He doesn't care. He opened up DonaldTrump.com/desk yesterday. That is going to quickly overtake everything else having to do with Donald Trump. But since it began taking cases in October, the oversight board at Facebook, get this number, has received more than 220,000 appeals from Facebook users, and it's issued 8 rulings. That'll tell you everything you need to know. You do need to read, and I will focus my third segment today on this most important op-ed by Ross Douthat, who may very well be the best columnist in America, except me, of course, in the Washington Post. Did Trump make everything progressive? In fact, I don't think he did. I think we're in the middle of a counter-reformation that began with President Obama's revolution, Donald Trump's reformation of that revolution, the counter-reformation in which we are watching Biden unfold, and the counter-counter-reformation, which is gathering steam, as best demonstrated in this book, The Tyranny of Big Tech. Senator Josh Hawley will be my guest tomorrow. That will also appear on the interview podcast. News from abroad that begins at home. Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, reject the claim of Cold War with China. The China czar inside the White House, a fellow by the name of Kirk Campbell, declared to the Financial Times conference yesterday that there were significant downsides to moving away from the policy of strategic ambiguity. It is time to tell the Chinese Communist Party and the People Liberation Army Navy that if they attack Taiwan, the United States will defend Taiwan. We resisted doing that right up until halfway through the Trump administration. Then, both to me and to others, Mike Pompeo and others began to clearly signal armed conflict would follow armed conflict, that force would be met with force. This backing away is simply a signal to the Chinese they can do what they want with Taiwan. Big mistake by the Biden administration. I think it could be a fatal mistake for Taiwan and thus for the Pacific. Mexico City railway bridge collapse, killing at least 24 people. The New York Times story on this horrific. The Capitol has been bracing for disaster for years, it writes. Ever since it opened only a decade ago, the Mexico City's newest subway line, a heralded expansion of the second largest subway system in the Americas, has been plagued with structural weaknesses that led engineers to warn of potential accidents. Now, I wouldn't myself travel on a subway with such warnings, but Mexicans had no choice. There was even a brief partial shutdown of this line in 2014. Yesterday, a subway train on the Golden Line plunged 50 feet. Think about those poor people, 50 feet of terror. After an overpass collapsed underneath it, 24 people were dead, injured a dozen more. The story on the toppling cars will continue for days. Prime Minister Netanyahu has had to turn back his recommend power to the president of Israel. He could not form a government. It's now in the hands of the anti-Netanyahu bloc. Will they be able to do so? They got a couple of weeks to do that. Netanyahu's 12 years in office may be coming to an end, but if they can't form a government, he wins by not losing. Another election would come up. I'll keep you posted. German defense spending is falling short. What a surprise. Donald Trump leaves office and the Germans begin to filch on their objectives that they had articulated to the Trump administration under pounding from Rick Grenell and others. In China, Chinese banks are accused of funding deforestation around the world. What a surprise. There are no vaccines in Africa, according to the Financial Times. They don't mean no vaccines. They just mean far fewer vaccines than necessary. And we fear the Indian example will be repeated there. Once again, I have these two stories on the bitterly divided reaction to America's new curriculum in the public schools, the anti-racist curriculum. I will get to them in the show today. One is from the Washington Post, one is from the New York Times. But if your school district is adopting an anti-racist curriculum, you have to take to the barricades. It's simply critical race theory disguised as high school and junior high curriculum. It's poison for young minds. Poison. I'll be right back, America. Don't forget, Highly Concentrated You is the podcast you find at the Hugh Hewitt Show, at every podcast everywhere, including iTunes, Spotify, and the Salem Podcast Network. The interview with Hugh Hewitt at the same place that I do two podcasts. One is to make sure you're informed. One is to make sure you're wise. And for both, stay tuned. Is this the way our story ends? Hey, man, sing me a song. When we were everyone, we were more than just a slice of America. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Good morning to you on this Wednesday. The Nixon Seminar met last night. I hope the video is now posted at NixonSeminar.com. If not, it will be posted shortly. It was terrific. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, former Secretary of State Pompeo, was not able to join us last night, so we reformatted it to feature only former National Security Advisor to President Trump, Robert C. O'Brien, and focused on how the National Security Council operates, should operate, is supposed to operate, will operate. Ran some clips, had a great discussion of the national security strategy. It was wonk heaven for people who care about national security matters, and I recommend it to you. It's the sort of stuff that you won't find anywhere on television or radio or podcast, thenixonseminar.com. And I was up late, but not so late that I wasn't able to read Ross Douthat's column, which I'm going to read to you now. Wow. My number, by the way, is 1-800-520-1234. Ross Douthat, for those of you who don't know, is a columnist for the New York Times, and he is the they have two conservative columnists there, three if you count David Brooks. David is more of a social critic, so I don't think I'm as a political columnist so much as I do as a genuinely smart, insightful, above it all columnist. Brett Stevens does a lot of international affairs and politics, and Ross Douthat looks at the United States very specifically. And he doesn't pick the title. The title is, Does Trump Make Everything Progressive? And it reads as such. And if you have a reaction as I'm reading this, call 1-800-520-1234. The latest transfixing document for our times is a public relations video for the Central Intelligence Agency. It features an unidentified 36-year-old Latina officer who speaks of her ascent through the ranks of the company in the hybrid language, partly the traditional American narrative of immigrant success, partly something more contemporary and ideological. I'm a woman of color. I'm a cisgender millennial who's been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. I am intersectional, but my existence is not a box-checking exercise. I refuse to internalize misguided patriarchal ideas of what a woman can or should be, close quote. Thus is a career in service to the American Imperium, at an institution dedicated to spycraft, drone strikes, and an occasional coup d'etat, now packaged at the fulfillment of a certain kind of cultural leftism and sold with buzzwords that almost nobody outside the academy would have recognized in the first term of Barack Obama. Whatever this change ultimately means for left-wing politics, the death of the anti-war left, the completion of progressivism marched toward through the institution, just the usual CIA's tricks, it's pretty remarkable to watch. Douthat continues, in my weekend column, I wrote about the political challenges that the rise of the so-called wokeness poses for the Democratic Party, the surmountable challenge created by its academic style of rhetoric, and the more substantial challenge should the new progressivism preside over policy disasters in the cities where it rules. It already does. Just visit Skid Row in Los Angeles. But it would take more, it would take more than just an electoral setback to reverse the ideological shifts that have taken us to the intersectional, anti-patriarchal, cisgender, and all-gender Central Intelligence Agency video. Indeed, the striking thing about the new progressivism advance is that it was seemingly accelerated by an electoral defeat, the shocking defeat of 2016 specifically, which by making Donald Trump president made a progressive revolution possible. I think Ross is wrong there, but I'll come back to that. At least that's the implication of an analysis making the rounds a little while after the woke CIA ad first appeared, in which Richard Hanania, who runs the Center for the Study of Partisan and Ideology, tried to explain why everything, meaning institutions that used to seem neutral or conservative from corporate America to the intelligence bureaucracy, have recently become so much more progressive, means woke, in positioning and rhetoric. Hanania argues that it's not simply that the millennials and Gen Z are more liberal, or that the Democrats are the professional class party, and so liberalism dominates professional spheres. These tilts are real, but there are still enough conservative-leaning consumers, enough young and wealthy and well-educated Republicans to create incentives for institutions to be apolitical or at least politically neutral. The key difference, he argues, isn't sheer numbers, but engagement, intensity, zeal. Liberals lately seem to care a lot more about politics, he argues. They donate more, they protest more, they agitate more in ways that change the incentives for public-facing institutions. Some of these gaps are longstanding, but others have opened only recently, with 2016 as the critical turning point. That was the year when the mobilization gap exploded, creating irresistible pressure from both within and outside corporations for them to take a stand on almost all hot-button issues. Why 2016? Well, probably because of Donald Trump. And Hanania's data, writes Douthat, his nomination election looks like a great accelerant, with the anti-Trump backlash driving hyper-liberal hyper-investment in politics to new heights, enabling progressives to achieve true mass mobilization in a way conservatives never have in a modern era. That, by the way, overlooks 1980. It overlooks 1994. And it overlooks 2016. That mobilization has consolidated progressive norms in almost every institution susceptible to pressure from activists or activist employees, and it's pulled the entire American establishment leftward. So that conservatives are suddenly at war with Major League Baseball, oh, yes, we are, and Coca-Cola, and yes, we are, instead of just Harvard and the Ford Foundation, as indeed we are, and the custodians of the national security state are eager to prove their enlightenment by speaking in the argot of the academic left. To some extent, this is an obvious point to anyone who watched the Trump era unfold. His administration's mix of haplessness and menace was a great gift to progressivism. I disagree with Roth here. Inspiring an anti-conservative reaction, which would have been the same. It was the same for George W. Bush. It was the same for Ronald Reagan. Believe me, I was there as a young lawyer in the White House. The Republicans got control of the Supreme Court in the bargain, but in almost every other institution, Douthat argues it matters, from Langley to corporate boardroom, their position got much worse. The rise of wokeness was accelerated by Trump, I have no doubt, says Douthat. Well, I do. I don't think it was Trump at all. I think it's been long forming, long growing, and it goes back to 9/11. And I'm gonna write about this for my column in the Washington Post. I want to know what you think at 1-800-520-1234. I don't think the left got bigger or accelerated, except in the breakdown of the media and its abdication either of its duty or it simply turned to the monetization of its left or right wing views. I think what we are seeing is a action-reaction, continual, ongoing, never going to stop feedback loop that sees the media reinforce left-wing politics, reinforcing the media's left-wing tilt, reinforcing the media's left-wing politics, with the exception of places like Fox News, podcasts, talk radio, and the Wall Street Journal. And these feedback loops just keep accelerating further and further to the left or to the right. Now, I believe the center right remains a very profitable place for politics, but I think a lot of the country is just sick of it. And there is a gathering counter reformation. So Bush and 9/11 was the time when politics really veered into saliency and higher norms of involvement. At the end of the Bush years, exhausted by wars, we got the revolution by President Obama, the expansion of executive power, expansion of the state, the rise of the hard left within the Democratic Party. 8 years, almost stopped by Mitt Romney, came this close, but Sandy and Candy derailed it. So it went for 8 years. And after those 8 years, there was a reformation, not a counter-revolution. I mean, a total paradigm shift with Donald Trump against Washington. Not a let's adopt Washington, but against the swamp. maybe not artfully carried out in every instance, but artfully carried out in many instances, denied by a liberal and left-wing media, but really it did happen. Trump got lots and lots done. And now Joe Biden is back with a counter-reformation. This is the language, by the way, of theology, and it applies. And we are now into the counter-counter-reformation gathering. Morning, Glory, America, bonjour, hi, candidate Hugh Hewitt. On the phone, John Allen of NBC News. Good morning, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Hugh?
I am great. The Indians came back and beat the Royals last night for their third consecutive win. They are only one game behind. I don't know how your Nats are doing. It's not a, you know, I'm not following the National League, and I'm kind of not buying any Major League Baseball merch or tickets this year because of the boneheaded move in Georgia. But you must know how the Nats are doing.
They, like everybody else at the NL East, are about 500. I think we're a game under 500 and within a game of first place.
All right. So, John, I wanted to talk to you about Ross Douthat's column in the New York Times, which argues that there is a sudden lurch left accelerated by Trump among all of the elite institutions. I see the same sudden lurch left. I trace it to before Trump. I don't know that Trump was an accelerant, but I'll tell you what, there's a counter-counter-reformation building, and I think Major League Baseball and Coca-Cola and Delta are all getting blowback. MLB's gone quiet on this stuff. The left has once again overestimated its strength. What do you think?
Well, I mean, they already decided to move the All-Star game, so I... I think the strength was there, and I don't know that I necessarily would put this in on a right left axis. I mean, obviously, a lot of people on the left were upset with what was going on in Georgia in terms of the election changes in baseball. But there's a long history in this country of companies deciding that the only color that matters is green. And so what we're moving towards societally is, these companies being put in a position of essentially choosing what has become a partisan side or what quickly becomes partisan on whatever the issue is.
I think they have been misled into believing that a non-consensus issue is a consensus issue and that the Georgia election law was morally bankrupt as opposed to a choice. I think it's voter reform. Democrats call it voter suppression. It certainly is more liberal in its rules than New York State or Colorado, ironically enough. But woke employees and woke groups are better at targeting sad sacks like Rob Manfred, and they got on the move. Coca-Cola's dialed it way back. They've retreated. They don't want any part about being Blue Coke, but although they're Blue Coke. I just think they've got to be more informed that they ought to stay for their shareholders focused on green, John. Is there any going back?
Look, we've watched corporations rebrand themselves for generations. I mean, BP becomes Beyond Petroleum. They pay people a lot of money to make sure that they market well. If they take a hit in the short term, I think most of them will be able to recover over the longer term. The other thing is over time, every company makes a variety of decisions, and we are in this polarized and intensely political time where everything that used to not be political is political. I don't know if that ends up passing, but what I do know is if you're mad at a company today, you may be less mad at them next week if you like.
Yeah, it's interesting, although I have not been into a Target save once when I forgot since they banned Salvation Army. Now, I don't call for boycotts. I've never been a boycott guy. I love the Salvation Army so much that when Target threw them out, it's probably been 12 years. I've only gone in once. I just simply forgot about it. I need razor blades or something. And I walked in. I said, oh, my gosh, I'm in a Target. I don't go into Target. And I really won't be flying Delta if I have a choice. And I am not going to buy Indians merch this year or go to a game. And I might carve myself an exception out if the playoffs or the series gets here. But that'll be up to me. In the meantime, no, I'll follow them from afar. John, my real question goes to whether or not the Democrats have blown their opportunity to seize the center again. I thought President Obama's big mistake was not going to the center and occupying the high ground. Joe Biden's gone hard left. He's not a hard leftist, but I don't know that he's in much control of his agenda here. Did they miss their opportunity to once again take the high ground that was there for the having?
I mean, we'll have to see how the next, we're 100 some odd days in, but there is something to be said for your point of view on this. I mean, I think what we've seen from Joe Biden is not necessarily what you saw during his campaign. I think he has been to the left of where he campaigned, and I think he only won because he was able to distance himself from a lot of the progressives in his party, and not necessarily aggressively, but you saw him being very careful about his positioning on some of the crucial issues down the stretch. So, and look, we've seen him leave in place some of the Trump policies, but for instance, the tariffs on China still being in place. We are looking at clearly a left of center presidency. Unlike Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson, you don't see him expanding the number of departments or agencies in government, but the amount of money that he's proposing to put through the system would really jack up the strength of the federal government. So that's certainly a Democratic point of view. Yeah, I mean, and he didn't start off with something that he could get through Congress on a bipartisan basis. So even the perception, I mean, bipartisanship is often the perception of centrism rather than actual centrism. But I think there was space for him to be more moderate, to be more like he had campaigned.
He chose not to do that. Now, I'm talking to Josh Hawley tomorrow about this book, which I hold in my hand, The Tyranny of Big Tech. And it's fascinating. The senators who write books that I actually like are like Sacred Duty by Tom Cotton or Ben Sasse's two books. Josh Hawley's book, he previously had written a scholarly book on TR. He's a John Roberts clerk. He's a smart guy. Big tech is in for a reckoning from the left because they don't like the concentration of wealth, from the right because they don't like the concentration of power. John, you know this town as well as anybody. Big tech has... they fortified their ranks. They're spending, I'll bet you, hundreds of millions of dollars in lobbying dollars. Can they defeat what is going to become a left-right punch on their position?
I think it's going to be very hard. And we've seen the forerunners for this across the globe. I mean, these companies are restricted in much stronger ways in Europe and a variety of other places. So, I think tech is in for a reckoning in Washington, and the question is going to be the details and whether these companies with huge lobbying arms, and in some cases it's not just the lobbying arm powerful, it's simply the fact that the members of Congress want to be close to them, or because they're household names. I think what you're going to see is a real fight over the details of regulation of tech and in some cases regulation of the tech sector is actually better for the big boys, and they have a lot of people who are really smart working on how to make sure any regulations give them carve outs or create an advantage for them going into the future. So
my favorite
details are going to matter a lot, because honestly there are more people at Facebook who understand what regulations would do than there are members of Congress.
I agree. But they're building a state within a state. I've been over to Facebook headquarters. I know Mark. I've talked to their team. I know what they're about. But my favorite appointment of the Biden administration is the young Yale academic to be chairman of the FTC, because she is an opponent of big tech. And I believe she is not going to want to leave her tenure without a significant antitrust action against big tech. Are you following that at all? Do you have the big tech beat at all, John, for NBC?
I don't have the beat per se. I believe I've done some hearings for NBC on the Hill with Zuckerberg and others. But, I follow it pretty closely. I think it's, unusual. You're going to find an issue where Elizabeth Warren and Josh Hawley are arm in arm. And what you've seen from the Biden administration is, to your point, that they're making appointments that clearly fall in the sort of populist camp. You know, whether you're talking about regulation of tech or you're talking about, you know, sort of other regulatory bodies.
I think it's fascinating because I think parents are becoming alarmed. And when parents become alarmed in America, that's when things change. And parents are becoming alarmed about the influence that big tech is on addicting their children and the consequential rise in teen depression, teen suicide, teen anomalies and maladies of all sorts. John Allen, D.C., J-O-N Allen, D.C. at Twitter, at NBC. Good friend, great guest. I'll be right back, America. More coming up on this Wednesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show, including a special day for the Hillsdale Dialogue.
So tired of all the darkness in our lives, with no more angry words to say.
33 minutes after the hour, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Good Wednesday morning to you. This is the second New York Times column I'm focusing on today. Ross Douthat in the first hour. Now Brett Stevens joins me. His column, Biden's Plan Promises Permanent Decline, is a must-read and a must-discuss. Brett, thank you for being with me this morning.
Always a pleasure, Hugh.
Brett, before I go to your column, I just want your quick reaction as an editor alum of the Jerusalem Post as to what appears to be Bibi's slipping grip on power. For the first time in 12 and a half years, he appears to be close to exiting the prime minister's residence.
Well, we'll see. I mean, there's still a number of possibilities for him. The Likud is still the largest party in government. It's not entirely surprising because a dozen years in power, and that's on top of 3 years in the 1990s, is an awfully long time. And I think part of his legacy is that anyone who conceivably replace him is going to be a right of center candidate, or at least what used to be considered a right of center candidate. So I don't think it's too soon to write his political obituary by a long stretch. But even if he does leave this time, he will have cemented a right wing or right of center block in Israel, which is significant.
Brett, I got to ask you, my parents, both of whom have gone to their rewards in the 90s, were Greatest Generation people. When FDR died, and they're both Republicans, I mean, they're very conventional Main Street Republicans, small town lawyer and a nurse. But when FDR died, they were college kids and a young soldier on a Pacific transport. And they both cried because FDR had been the president for their entire lives and they didn't know what was going to happen. They were afraid and they were worried. I mean, we were in a war. Is there going to be a generation like that in Israel that don't know anybody but Netanyahu?
A little bit different because Israel has not spent the last 4 years engaged in massive war, along with, you know, surviving a Great Depression on the other hand, on the contrary side, some of its greatest economic prosperity ever, and the wars have been fought in the shadows. But yeah, I think Israel's going to have a hard time figuring out how to govern itself because he's so dominated the scene.
All right, let's turn to your column. I want to read two paragraphs of it and then expand. President Biden, writes Brett this morning, charts a course towards the largest expansion of government since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. After signing a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill in March and proposing a $1.5 trillion discretionary budget in April, a 16% increase from this year, on top of that, what's likely to be $3 trillion in mandatory spending on programs like Medicare and Medicaid, the president wants $2.3 trillion more for infrastructure and $1.8 trillion for new social programs. That's $7.5 trillion in discretionary spending. To put a number in perspective, we spent $4.1 trillion in inflation-adjusted dollars over nearly 4 years to wage and win the Second World War. Brett, my hat is off to you. You're the first person who's managed to put this into terms that I think the average American, Bill Bennett says we have a numbers problem when we get to numbers this size. It's an astonishing amount of money. That's all he's doing. He is going to transform America by spending money.
Well, yeah, and transform it in a way that's irreversible. And that's the point I also make in the column, because it's one thing if, say, you you want to spend a lot of money to put a man on the moon. Well, eventually the Apollo program is going to end and you will have had a technical and a humanistic achievement, but that's over. But when you're spending on programs like universal pre-K or paid parental leave, those things never go away. So what ends up happening is that the government's share of our gross domestic product is going to grow something like a French-like proportion, which is close to 50% of GDP. If you add all those numbers up, coming around $8 or $9 trillion, our GDP is $21 trillion. And so that's close to 50%. And so that brings you into French territory, and it's worth taking a look at how things are going in France. And it turns out it's not just, you know, joie de vivre and promenading along the Champs-Élysées.
Well, Brett, we have a cliche that came to life yesterday. Janet Yellen said the quiet part out loud. She said we're going to have to raise interest rates because inflation is here. That rocked the market. She walked it back. There's a couple of stories from the Wall Street Journal yesterday. Yellen says interest rates must go down. Yellen says interest rates must go up. Yellen says interest rates won't go up. I think inflation is a lock, mortal lock, as they say in the horse racing business. But mortal locks in the horse racing business don't always come. Brian Westbury is joining me after the break. What do you think is the consequence in the United States of this kind of spending, which is, it's actually exponentially larger than anything we've ever seen outside of war. And it's even double what we saw inside of war.
Well, I've been saying for months that we're going to see major inflation in 2021. Some of my colleagues have disagreed with me, but now I think it's almost indisputable. And the problem with inflation is that once it's out there, it's very hard to rein in except through a great deal of pain. Paul Volcker in the late 1970s and early 1980s proved that point. And there's some idea out there that inflation has been permanently bested in the United States. I think that's crazy. We haven't escaped the laws of economics. Inflation is a very painful phenomenon. I lived in Mexico City in the early 1980s when I saw peso devalue and prices rise dramatically. And it was traumatic for people, but at least back then you had the anchor of the United States. What happens when your anchor, the global anchor itself, goes adrift? That's a big question.
The theory is that as the reserve currency, the dollar can never inflate. That's the radical's theory. I think that is wrong because I bought my first house at 13.5% interest rate. It was an $85,000 house in 1985 with the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, and we were nuts to do that. But I think 13.5% interest rate, even though right now they're at 3.5 or 2.5, I think that can't stay, Brett, and that's why we have a housing shortage.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And of course, you know, inflation is almost definitionally too much money chasing too few goods. If you have a lot of money in circulation, you're going to see major increases in prices. And we have a funny way of calculating inflation in this country, you know, so-called core inflation prices. But the reality is that we've had massive asset inflation, you know, going on for a great many years. So it's very, you know, it's very difficult to buy increasingly small properties for under, you know, $500,000, if not $1 million in many places of this country. Wages and incomes are simply not keeping pace with that. Things are more expensive for people.
My colleague on a book against the fair tax a few years ago, Deloitte partner, now retired and teaching accounting, wrote a column recently telling people that if the Biden tax proposal goes through, the stepped up basis elimination or greatly reduced stepped up basis will have a devastating effect on the working wealthy because of their homes and the asset bases that have increased. Do you think America is aware of the impact of the Biden tax proposal in any kind of a realistic way?
Well, that's a future column that I plan to write. I just didn't have time for it. You know, there's this idea that it's just Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk who are going to, you know, write a check for all of this largesse. But this is going to hit the upper middle class, which in many places in this country, places like New York, really, you know, are come down to sort of the middle class. This is one of the great lies of the Democratic Party that quote unquote rich will pay for everything. The reality is that the middle or upper middle class will end up bearing the great burden of these tax increases in ways that they can scarcely afford. So there's going to be a massive massive drop in their standard in their standard of living. It's going to go to things like how they pay for their college tuitions or the homes in which they live. They're going to see an absolute reduction in their in their standard of life. It's not just a little bit more money off the top. This is a reality that I think is going to sink in pretty quickly, and it's going to have adverse consequences for the Democrats, but maybe not enough to save us from a permanent social welfare state.
I do believe that stepped up basis is in trouble because Hank make and before you write yours, look up Hank Adler and stepped up basis or town hall. He wrote it at town hall. It will cripple the Democrats in coastal cities because coastal cities have real estate inflation, some of which is leveraged, and it will have to be sold when parents die. When there is no stepped up basis, they're just going to the kids are going to inherit. And the kids are going to have to sell it. In some cases, there's not going to be anything because the government's going to take so much and the leverage will have been spent on education. But, Brett, bottom line, we have a congressional election in 2022. Does all this spending and all this taxation, along with redistricting and gerrymandering, you know, Democrats will help Democrats, Republicans will help Republicans wherever possible. Does it add up to a nightmare for Democrats?
I think it's going to add up to a big nightmare in 22, but whether the Republican Party can save itself from itself in 24 is the big question.
Expand on that.
Well, I mean, think about the shellacking that Obama took in 2010 or Clinton in 94. Both of them led to re-election because the Republicans couldn't find a candidate that could defeat the incumbent, and they couldn't elect Congresses that had enough internal cohesion and discipline to not present an easy target for the incumbent president. That's what Newt Gingrich did for Bill Clinton with the government shutdown in 1995. Let's see if the Republicans can avoid that kind of mistake. And remember, it's a very divided party even now. With you know, ideologically very disparate factions, a great deal of infighting. That those are easy political pickings for an incumbent Democratic administration. So
well observed. Well observed. The key question is though, does Joe Biden have the political skill set or the staff that President Clinton and Obama did? It seems to me that that's a completely different lineup, to use a sports metaphor. What last comment to you, Brett?
I think your point is absolutely right.
Always good to talk to Brett when he says something like that. And it's good to talk to him, whatever. Go get his new column, Biden's Plan Promises Permanent Decline. The scale of this spending is simply staggering, as are the tax increases. And I believe the country knows it. I think that's why they're rushing it. And I do not believe it will be successfully pushed through. Brett's interview will, of course, be part of today's Hugh Hewitt Highly Concentrated Hugh podcast. I'm reminding everyone, got a call from a senator yesterday. We talked a little bit about it's actually texting with a senator yesterday, about the podcast. And the apology came, well, they were actually going to prefer the podcast over listening to the show because they only got part of the show in the time that they had allocated to the morning, but that the Highly Concentrated Hugh, which is the rundown in the morning, plus all of the interviews, minus the Hillsdale Dialogue, which this week is today on Wednesday, not Friday, that was just more efficient. So go to Spotify, go to iTunes, type in Hugh Hewitt Show, and you'll get to my daily podcast, which is Highly Concentrated, or you'll get to the interview with Hugh Hewitt. Both of those podcasts, the first makes you smart, the second makes you wise. They're different. You need them both. You also need relieffactor.com 3 times a day. 5 days a week. I tell you, relieffactor.com needs to be a part of your diet. I take it every morning. If you're a late listener, you don't hear me do it, but I do every morning. I take it. Why? Because after the show is when I exercise, and unless it's raining, and I don't know what it's doing in the Beltway today. I haven't even looked outside yet because you can't tell in the dark and you got to wait. I do not like people who complain about how they hurt, who don't try everything that would help them not hurt. And that means relieffactor.com. $19.95 is a 3-week starter pack. Try it. If it doesn't work, then stop. Brian Westbury, First Trust Portfolio, our favorite economist, joins me next on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, best economist on the air anywhere is Westbury. Brian Westbury of First Trust Portfolio, where he is the chief economist. I just tweeted out Brian's blog because you ought to be reading it. Good morning, Brian. How are things? And I don't know if you're in the Windy City or if you've gone to Arizona. I don't know where you are anymore.
Yes, I'm in Illinois. I swear I'm going to buy a U-Haul and just stick it next to my – I just need to fill it and go. That's
you need to, need to do. Nomad land for Brian. Janet Yellen spooked everyone yesterday, Brian. What was she saying, and what is inflation going to be in this country?
Yeah, it's inflation is heading up. See, this, at least somebody in Washington utters the truth every once in a while. You cannot, and this is what the Fed has done, increase the money supply, and this is – it's called M2. We have M1, M2, M3. M2 is basically all deposits in all U.S. banks. And that number, the amount of money in the economy has increased by 24% in the past year. The only other time that I can find in history that might be remotely close is 1942 and 43. When we fought World War II and we just printed money to kind of help us with the production of war goods. And so we haven't seen this in 80 years. I mean, it's unprecedented. I keep using that. People think unprecedented means, oh, it's the first time in a long time. No, this is the first time ever.
Ever.
And when you have that kind of money printing and this kind of spending, especially on redistribution, you end up with inflation. And we're going there. The only question is how fast it shows up.
Now, Brian, I just had Brett Stevens on. He's written a wonderful column in the New York Times today, calling out, totaling up all of Biden's spending and proposed spending, $7.5 trillion. That is more than the inflation-adjusted $4.1 trillion we spent in 4 years to wage and win the Second World War. So the inflationary pressures are extraordinary. What kind of level of inflation do you expect to see? We see it in home markets already. It's crazy out there, artificially held down by a kind of de facto price control of lower interest rates held down by the Fed. But what's going to happen to lumber and milk? What's going to happen to cars?
Yes. Yeah. Well, we've already seen it, Hugh. I want to go back to the beginning of that really quickly, just government borrowing, just deficit spending isn't by itself inflationary. And so we need to think of it this way. If I go borrow money from somebody and then give it to somebody else, that does not create additional money. And the person I borrow it from can't spend it. The one I give it to obviously does. So you don't create any new money. What we've done differently this time is that the Federal Reserve has printed money to buy the government bonds that are being issued. And that's called modern monetary theory. And we won't go into it here, at least I don't think. And so that's when you get inflation, when you add new money to the system. On top of that, by shutting down the economy, but you can't turn off the economy like a light switch. It does, and then flip it back on, and everything's the same as it was. There are shortages of semiconductors. There are fewer workers in industries. There are supply chain problems. Truckers aren't driving because they're getting paid to stay home. All of these things start to add up, and then you get shortages, and that boosts prices in the face of all this new money coming in to spend. And so what we're seeing right now is a huge spike in inflation. Lumber prices, record high. Corn, 7-year high. Oil, back to almost $70 a barrel. Gasoline, $3 a gallon. It's going to be over any day now. Diesel fuel, $3 a gallon. The truckers cost more. Everything costs more. Some of that inflation will dissipate. So the Fed keeps using this word. Inflation is transitory. It's right now what we're seeing won't last. There's a piece of that that's true because these supply chains will get fixed maybe not perfectly, and that's going to be a problem in the future, but they will get fixed, which will help us lower those prices a little bit. But with all this money flooding in, any pause in inflation will just be temporary itself. And then by the end of 2022, gosh, right now, we're actually seeing underlying inflation pick up. And I'm really worried about 2020, late 2022, 23, 24. The only question will it show up to make a difference in for politicians? Because inflation is not friendly to politicians. All you have to do is go back in history and look at what happened to politicians, either governors, mayors, or presidents, or congressmen and women during times of inflation. It is not a good environment to pay for voters.
I think it's already here, Brian. People, young people trying to buy a house, I think they already know what Joe Biden has done to them. Brian, keep coming back. You're the clearest economist I've ever met, and we need you back more often. Follow him at Westbury. Go find his blog at First Trust Portfolio. Find me next hour. It's the Hillsdale Dialogue, a special time this week. So tune in next hour. It's Federalist 10, friends. It's especially for the Ruthless Podcast people.